From WBUR in Boston, I'm Karen Given, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Bill Littlefield is away this week, and so are the goat-ridden Cubs. Ahead on Only a Game, a baseball postseason update, including possible new evidence that Philadelphia fans may be willing to remain positive throughout the Phillies' postseason run. Also, a conversation with Kevin Cook, author of Driven, Teen Phenoms, Mad Parents, Swing Science, and the Future of Golf. Also ahead, pro athletes donate their brains to a new study on concussions.
I knew I wasn't going to need it once I died, so, and as far as I know, no one's doing brain transplants yet, so if I can help further the science and understanding of concussions in the future, then I'm very willing to do it.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given, in for Bill Littlefield. Those who hoped the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim would earn new wings this season suffered another blow last night. A late two-run homer by J.D. Drew pushed the Red Sox ahead 7-5. The Angels are now down 2-0 as the series heads to Boston tomorrow. In the other American League Divisional Series, the Tampa Bay Rays continued their march to the World Series with a 6-2 win over the Chicago White Sox. That series also stands 2-0, and the White Sox have a chance to avoid the sweep at home tomorrow. In the National League, the Los Angeles Dodgers will try to make it a solid century of misery for Cubs fans. A win tonight in L.A. will eliminate Chicago from their best-of-five divisional series. In the other NLDS, the Phillies also enjoy a 2-0 lead. They'll play the Brewers tonight in Milwaukee. Here to discuss the Phillies and their postseason and chances is David Murphy, who covers the team for the Philadelphia Daily News and writes his High Cheese blog at philly.com. David, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you.
In a recent blog, you explain how Philadelphia fans, who are notorious for their negativity, might be willing to summon their positive energy to cheer the Phillies on to their first World Series title in 28 years. To what extent were the fans responsible for the results in Game 1 and 2?
I don't know if the fans are ever directly responsible for a win, but there was one particular moment in the Phillies' win over the Brewers in Game 2 in which I think you could say they were definitely playing a big role. Brett Myers, the Phillies' starting pitcher, was at bat with two out in the second inning, and he was facing left-hander CeCe Sabathia, who's regarded as one of the toughest pitchers in the league by far. And, you know, he ended up working a nine-pitch walk, and with each ball that Sabathia threw, the crowd got louder and louder and louder, and, you know, you could see him get rattled out there on the mound. So I would say, you know, the crowd makes a difference in small moments like that, but I don't know if you could ever say they're directly responsible for a victory or a loss.
Most Philadelphia fans will tell you it's been 25 years since the city last celebrated a pro sports championship when the 76ers won the 1983 NBA title. But that's not quite true. Was nobody paying attention this past July when the Philadelphia Soul won the 2008 Arena Football title?
That's a good question. I think there were some people paying attention, but I think, if anything, it was rubbing the salt in the wound of the professional sports fans in the town who, you know, have gone so long without a title, and all of a sudden this upstart Arena League team comes in and wins one. And, you know, we can't forget about Villanova back in 1985, I think it was, won a national title, and uh-huh. That was kind of a city championship. And, you know, there have been some minor sports like lacrosse and indoor soccer that have brought home some titles, but I think everybody in the city is waiting for the big one, and I think they're hoping the Phillies can bring it to them this year.
The Phillies' win against the Brewers in Game 1 on Wednesday was the team's first playoff win since 1993. I don't suppose that Philadelphians will take solace in that should the Phillies fail to go all the way.
No, it's a town with a one-track mind. You know, it's title or bust. And, you know, they were happy with the playoff berth last year, and they're certainly thrilled with a couple of wins this year. But, you know, at this point, you know, expectations rise with each victory, and at this point in time, you know, the expectations are World Series, and I think anything short of that definitely will be viewed as a disappointment by the city.
Had fans already gotten behind the team before the postseason began?
Yeah, you know, the Phillies set some records this year. They sold out 50 games, 50 of their 81 home games. They set an attendance record with over 3.5 million people. So, yeah, I mean, the fans have been there pretty much from the jump this year. It's kind of been building ever since Citizens Bank Park, their new stadium, opened in 2004. But, yeah, I would definitely say that the interest in the team is at a point where it hasn't been since that 1993 team kind of captured the heart of the city. It's definitely not a front-running town, not a bandwagon town. I mean, the people have been coming out all season and going back to last season, which is why I think they all want a title.
Milwaukee hadn't made the playoffs in 26 years, but I guess the Phillies might not be too sympathetic about that.
No, and it's interesting. The Brewers last made the playoffs in 1982 and are kind of in a situation where the Phillies were last year, you know, in their first playoff series, down 2-0, kind of overwhelmed by the whole experience. And, you know, they're not going to be sympathetic. The fans certainly aren't sympathetic. You know, they weren't sympathetic last night by any means. And I guess from the Philadelphia fans' point of view, they'll look at Milwaukee fans and say, hey, you had the Packers for 10 years and saw a Super Bowl title and saw Brett Favre play. And, you know, I've had Wisconsin football and plenty of things to cheer about. But, you know, Philadelphians, you know, it's not just baseball. I mean, the Eagles haven't won a Super Bowl. The Flyers haven't won a Stanley Cup. There has been no Brett Favre in Philadelphia to lead them to a Super Bowl title. So I think that's why you wouldn't see too much sympathy from that end.
Game 3 is scheduled to take place tonight in Milwaukee. How will the Phillies fare almost 1,000 miles away from their diehards?
Well, it'll be interesting. They played 2 games here this year, back in April, I think it was, and they won one and they lost one. You know, I think the key to the game or one of the big keys will be the veteran left-hander that's on the mound for the Phillies, 45-year-old Jamie Moyer, who's been nothing short of spectacular this year. Led the team with 16 victories in the regular season, and has just had a knack for coming up big at big moments. So I think they're ready to go. I think they'll be all right.
David Murphy covers the Phillies for the Philadelphia Daily News and writes the High Cheese blog about the team at philly.com. Thanks, David.
Yeah, thanks a lot. It was a pleasure.
Chivas USA stands a very good chance to make the 2008 MLS playoffs. They're doing so with the help of star players Ante Razov and Aleko Eskandarian. But they've also gotten a lift from a player whose unlikely path to the MLS took him through a reality TV show. Only a Game's Charlie Schroeder has our story.
It's 2 hours before kickoff between the visiting Kansas City Wizards and Chivas USA, and I'm combing the Home Depot Center's parking lot for a Chivas fan who can talk to me about Major League Soccer's latest teen phenom, Jorge Flores. So when I see a bunch of guys dressed in Chivas jerseys pounding cans of Modelo beer behind their truck, I approach them.
What do you think of, do you know Sueño, the player?
I don't know.
No, he
doesn't
speak
Spanish. No, Spanish, how about you?
No, I don't. I know Chava Reyes for Chivas.
Oh, okay. But Jorge Flores, you don't know him?
No, I don't.
This surprises me. After all, Flores has received a lot of media attention this season, especially on Spanish-language TV. Last year, the teenager beat out 2,000 other hopefuls on the Univision reality show Sueño MLS. Sueño is Spanish for dream, and the show's winner earned just that, a tryout with Chivas USA, one of Los Angeles's 2 Major League Soccer teams. Flores subsequently earned a spot on the team and a new nickname to boot, Sueño. Still, for all his recent success, it takes me about 20 attempts to finally find someone who knows who he is. But he's not in the parking lot. He's in the media room.
He has had a meteoric rise, shall we say, and he's scored some pretty important goals for Chivas USA already this season, a handful of goals, which is unusual for a player to mature that rapidly when he turns professional.
That's the soccer writer Nick Green of the LA Daily News. He tells me Flores spent part of his childhood in nearby Anaheim, where he played high school soccer, and part of the time in Mexico.
And so that's what also makes him a very appropriate player for Chivas USA, which has a very small fan base in Major League Soccer and is trying to cultivate that. And so it'll be players like Jorge Flores that will help him do that.
Most fans here today are, like Flores, Mexican-American. One of them, George Robles, tells me he likes Sueño because of his backstory.
Man, he came from nowhere, man. He came from Santana, you know? What else you want? He's a hometown guy, you know? We have to give him all the love we have to, you know? You know, a lot of people tried out for El Sueño, MLS, and one guy made it. And think I was a local guy, you know?
A few seats away, I spot another fan, Richard Escuchia. dressed in a referee shirt with a pair of drumsticks tucked in the front of his shorts. Later, he'll play all sorts of musical instruments to help cheer on Chivas USA. He likens Flores' good luck to achieving the American dream.
That goes to show you that in America, pretty much if you really want it, you go and take it, and if things work out, you will get it.
Flores hasn't quite gotten it yet, however. After a dreamlike spring in which he scored goals in three consecutive games, his playing time and productivity have decreased considerably. In fact, tonight he'll spend the entire game warming the bench. Flores' dream is also another big thing. Money. The 19-year-old currently makes the MLS minimum wage, $17,700. Again, soccer writer Nick Green.
In contrast to other sports leagues, Major League Soccer has a very low salary cap in order to keep expenses low for its teams, and that means that some of its players don't make very much money.
Back out on the pitch, Sasha Victorin scores with just seconds left in the first half to give Chivas a 2-0 lead heading into halftime. Despite being outplayed in the second half, they hold on to win 2-1 and remain in second place behind division leader Houston. After the game, I sit down with Flores in a Chivas conference room. He looks like he could be heading to a club. His hair is moussed and spiky. He wears trendy jeans and chews gum. Every now and then he sends a text message on his cell phone. In short, he's just like every other 19-year-old you meet, except for the fact that he won a spot on a professional soccer team by winning a reality show.
Last year that I was here, I think that a lot of people thought that I wasn't going to make it, but, you know, and I'm working hard and trying to get some minutes in the first team.
And he tells me he's working hard to fulfill his dreams.
Yeah, I always wanted to play in Mexico because I was born here but raised in Mexico, and I always wanted to play over there. I still have that goal, or Europe.
What teams?
Mexico, I would like to play with Pumas. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Europe, whichever team.
English Premier
League? Yeah, English, Spain, Italy, the big leagues.
The big leagues. Now, that would be a dream. For Only a Game, I'm Charlie Schroeder in Carson, California.
Thirteen years to the day after O.J. Simpson was acquitted of murdering his ex-wife and her friend, Simpson and his co-defendant were convicted last night of robbing two sports memorabilia dealers at gunpoint in a Las Vegas hotel room. It took the jury 13 hours to return guilty verdicts on all 12 of the charges against Simpson and Clarence Stewart. The defense had argued the incident a year ago was not a robbery, but Simpson's attempt to reclaim property, he says, had been stolen from him. Four of the prosecution's chief witnesses had been charged in the case, but struck plea deals in return for their testimony. Simpson was immediately jailed pending sentencing on December 5th. The 61-year-old could spend anywhere from 5 years to the rest of his life in prison. Simpson's attorney says he will appeal the verdict. It's 19 minutes past the hour. On Sunday in the German town of Ravensburg, about 15,000 people completed what just might be the largest jigsaw puzzle in history. 1,141,800 pieces were assembled, forming a 6,500-square-foot masterpiece that threatened to overrun the town square with images of maps, landscapes, and animals. The Guinness Book has received the record submission, which, if approved, would shatter the existing record of 212,000 pieces set in Singapore in 2002. Said Ravensburg resident Sonja Hosner, "We really like puzzling." I'm Karen Givens, sitting in for Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Charlie Pierce casts his vote for a new Golden State Warriors mascot. But first,
this is the brain of John Grimsley, who is
Dr. Anne McKee is becoming accustomed to showing slides of former NFL linebacker John Grimsley's brain. Dr. McKee is the co-director for Boston University's new Center for the Study of Traumatic Encephalopathy, which announced last week that more than a dozen athletes have agreed to donate their brains to study the long-term effects of concussions. McKee says Grimsley's brain showed extensive damage.
It's called chronic traumatic encephalopathy, and he seems to have a milder form than we usually see in end-stage boxers, but still quite severe. And so what you're looking at is just every time you can see this very dark brown pigment, that's actually this abnormal protein that's been deposited in his brain. And if under normal circumstances, you would see none of this in a 45-year-old. It's extremely unusual to see tau deposition in a 45-year-old, and this amount of tau deposition would be extraordinarily unusual.
McKee wasn't surprised by what she found in John Grimsley's brain. The same damage has been found in five other athletes, all who died young under tragic circumstances. But Dr. McKee doesn't want to see an end to football as we know it. She's a lifelong Packers fan who proudly displays a bobblehead of Brett Favre on the shelf above her desk.
I love football. You know, it's gotten really brutal out there. You saw the hit in the Jets game this weekend. That's got to be, I think, considered quite seriously.
In case you didn't see it, McKee is talking about Eric Smith's hit on Arizona's Anquan Boldin on Sunday, and it sounded something like this. With just 27 seconds left in the Cardinals' loss, Boldin went for the ball, got sandwiched between two Jets defenders, and was unconscious before he hit the ground.
Ooh, that's helmet-to-helmet by Eric Smith. That should have been flagged right there.
Yeah, that's going to bring about a fine, but which obviously is...
Boldin believes the hit was unintentional, but the NFL fined Eric Smith $50,000 and suspended him for one game anyway. The hits taken by the late John Grimsley and the other deceased NFL players diagnosed with CTE might not have been on their minds when they retired, but Dr. McKee says the damage to their brains is undeniable.
10 or 20 years later, when they're in their 40s and 50s, they may develop some subtle behavioral changes, irritability, sort of impulsivity, difficulty making decisions, maybe some slight lapses of memory, maybe depression, some sort of subtle changes. And those may continue until the person actually develops cognitive changes, Parkinsonian features, maybe even gait and speech changes.
All of the former NFL players who've been diagnosed with CTE died young. But McKee says experience with the disease in boxers suggests that, like Alzheimer's, the disease keeps progressing until death.
You know, if we could identify them while they're living, then we can hopefully treat it. There are a lot of new treatments on the horizon in Alzheimer's disease. There's a lot of emphasis right now on preventing this buildup of tau, which also occurs in Alzheimer's disease, by the way. And so maybe, you know, with more attention to this disorder, and we can actually start moving in the direction where we do some clinical trials on preventing tau buildup in these individuals.
You know, part of the reason I push so hard is because I'm in that risk category, and, you know, theoretically, I might have 10 years before I need a cure to this protein building in our brains.
Everyone involved in this project says Chris Nowinski is the guy who's making it happen. It's not what the former Harvard football player and pro wrestler thought he'd be doing with his life.
No. I mean, considering I didn't know what a concussion was until I was 24, it's hard to believe that I would end up being the brain guy. But now that's what everybody knows me as. It's kind of a weird spot. And now that I'm collecting them.
Nowinski's been collecting brains, so to speak, since 2007. He retired from the WWE with post-concussion syndrome and wrote a book about concussions and football. Soon after, Nowinski thought something was not quite right in reports of former NFL star Andre Waters' suicide. So he contacted Waters' family, and the Eagles' safety became the first former NFL player diagnosed with CTE. Nowinski did the same with the families of Mike Webster, Terry Long, Justin Strelzik, and the wrestler Chris Benoit. Even before her husband died, Virginia Grimsley was aware of Chris Nowinski. John Grimsley was having memory trouble and had developed a bit of a temper. Virginia dismissed it as getting older until she saw Nowinski talking about CTE on HBO's Real Sports in May of 2007. A few days later, Virginia convinced her husband to sit down in front of the TV.
His silence after watching that said more than anything he could actually verbally say. You know, I asked him, I said, well, I said, honey, do you remember how many concussions do you think you had? He goes, well, I can remember at least 8, but those are the ones I can remember. He said, probably more.
Virginia never was able to convince her husband to see a doctor about his symptoms. And just 9 months later, John Grimsley was dead. Even in her grief, she remembered that HBO program and Chris Nowinski.
I was in with our pastor, the church, trying to put together the services for the funeral. And a friend of mine, who's a nurse, a registered nurse, she came and interrupted the meeting. She says, I'm sorry, but this is really important. I have to talk to you now. And she told me, she said, well, this is Chris Nowinski. And immediately I knew who he was. And I said, yeah, it's him. I know what he wants. Just where do I sign?
Chris Nowinski co-founded the Sports Legacy Institute to bring attention to the problem, and he's always on the lookout for new cases. But he thinks the cause and effect has already been well established.
There really is absolutely no doubt left in the game. The only people that are holding out and saying we still need to do more research are people who make billions of dollars off of it, and that's the NFL, that's WWE. I mean, the NHL doesn't even have the guts to say anything that this isn't a real problem. So, this is just like smoking was, a few decades ago. But it's black and white at this point. You know, if you play contact sports for a number of years, your brain might end up with an inch of dead tissue, around it, which is what these pictures kind of look like.
Nowinski's latest challenge is to take the issue beyond former NFL players, who have gotten the most attention so far, to other athletes. When plans for BU's new brain study center were announced last week, Nowinski had lined up 6 former NFL players, including New England's Ted Johnson, and 6 athletes from other sports, including the National Hockey League's Noah Welch and Cindy Parlow, a former member of the U.S. national soccer team. Parlow took her most recent concussion during the bronze medal game at the 2003 Women's World Cup.
I guess that's what I get for having a good vertical jump and being 6 feet tall, is that I beat the people to the ball, but unfortunately they still had my head.
Parlow knows better than most that it's not just pro football players who suffer concussions, and she didn't hesitate to pledge her brain to research.
Not really. I mean, I knew I wasn't going to need it once I died, and as far as I know, no one's doing brain transplants yet, so if I can help further the science and understanding of concussions and in the future, then I'm very willing to do it.
Nowinski's finding that lots of athletes are willing to do whatever they can. He's been too busy over the past week or so to call the pros and get more of them to sign up, but that hasn't slowed the growth of his ever-expanding roster of willing study subjects.
Well, what's interesting is that, it started with 12, and it was 16 2 days later. And then after the story came out, a ton of college athletes came out of the woodwork and started emailing us. So the people that have pledged to donate is now, 30 or 40. I would not be surprised if this number is in the hundreds by the end of the year and thousands in a year or two, because, everybody wants to be a part of it. Everybody realizes what a problem it is.
With every new case, scientists learn more about the disease, but there are still questions. Dr. Robert Cantu was Nowinski's personal doctor when he was suffering from post-concussion syndrome. He's one of the nation's leading experts on concussions, and he's the co-founder of Nowinski's Sports Legacy Institute.
We don't have the answers to the questions like, who is at risk? What is it that puts some person at risk for traumatic encephalopathy and somebody else has what appears to be the same amount of trauma and comes out unscathed? What are the genetic factors or what are the other factors? We don't even know the prevalence of it.
There's one question that already seems to be answered. Experts say going back to play too soon after an injury not only increases the likelihood of another concussion, but can greatly intensify the damage caused by that subsequent injury. Dr. Cantu recommends that coaches and doctors use every resource available to them to make sure an athlete has fully recovered, including neuropsychological testing.
you need to make sure you read all the directions, because for some sections you need to right-click on the mouse, some you need to left-click on the mouse.
In her cramped office in the Tufts University training room, assistant athletic trainer Patricia Cordero leads me through one such neuropsychological test called the impact test. I'm setting my baseline with a series of memory games and motor speed tests. All incoming contact sport athletes at Tufts set their baseline before ever stepping on a court, diving platform, or practice field. Arizona Cardinals receiver Anquan Boldin took the test, too, before this season began.
Oh, no.
On Thursday, Anquan Boldin took the impact test again to help determine whether it was safe for him to return to the field. Pat Cordero says athletes often want to compete so badly that they'll downplay their symptoms.
So they can tell us that they feel fine, they don't have a headache, they're not tired, they're doing well in class, but when we do the testing, it's sensitive enough to pick up any weaknesses that they have.
Sometimes athletes don't realize they're still impaired after a concussion. That's what happened to Kelly, a Tufts volleyball player from 2003 to 2007. She had a history of two concussions from snowboarding before a freak elbow through the net took her out of action for most of her junior season. After a month of headaches, nausea, sensitivity to light, and feeling out of it, Kelly thought she was better. But the impact test indicated otherwise.
It's really amazing to see on your baseline test how easy it was, and then just being so frustrated, and you know, you can't understand why you thought you did so well, and you get your readout and it's, you know, you're in the 50s or in the 60s.
Kelly's injury happened before Chris Nowinski founded the Sports Legacy Institute and before studies of the brains of John Grimsley and others showed a disease that starts chipping away at personality and memory in a person's 40s and 50s. Kelly now knows about a few of those dangers, and even though she's been fully recovered for nearly 3 years, she still worries about it.
There are times when I'm reading the newspaper and then I go to talk about it and I can't remember what was in the article. You know, and it could be, you know, I'm done with college, I've got a job, and I'm busy, and I'm working a lot, and I'm tired. And so I think it's hard to distinguish whether that's to blame or whether it's long-term effects. But what I do know is that I never used to be like this. And I'm 23, so so I can't imagine what's to come if this is what's going on now.
Kelly says if she had it to do all over again, she'd live her life the same way, except she might be more willing to wear a helmet while snowboarding. Chris Nowinski, who finally shook the migraines and post-concussion symptoms 5 years after his most recent concussion, isn't so sure.
Football got me a lot of places, and I love playing the game, and I love the guys I play with, and I'm really close to them all. But if you'd asked me while I had one of those headaches over the last 5 years, I would have said I wouldn't dare have done it again. And if you ask me now in 10 years if I suddenly can't remember my kids' names, I'll say no way. I mean, today I feel good. So I'd say, you know, maybe it was all worth it. You know, we got to put this big issue on the map. But the fact of the matter is it has taken a lot away from me, and it'll probably take a lot more.
Nowinski talks as if the day he displays symptoms of CTE is inevitable. But in the meantime, the former wrestler is using all his contacts to bring more attention to the issue. On Monday, Jesse Ventura will be the keynote speaker for a no-holds-barred $500-a-seat fundraiser for the Sports Legacy Institute. You can share your comments with Only a Game by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860 or visit Only a Game's website, onlyagame.org. You're listening to Only a Game. The Cincinnati Bengals won the NFL's AFC North Division in 2005. They haven't had a winning season since, and this year they're off to an 0-4 start. Joining us now to discuss if the Bengals can change their stripes is Cincinnati Inquirer columnist and WLW radio host Paul Dougherty. Paul, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you very much for having me.
Paul, Bengals quarterback Carson Palmer hadn't missed a start in more than 3 years. Then he missed last Sunday's game. Should Bengals fans be concerned?
Yes, they should be concerned if the Bengals decide to play him this weekend in Dallas, because their offensive line has been atrocious and they can't afford to lose Carson any more than they already have.
These days, the Bengals seem to be known more for a certain wide receiver changing his name than for anything else. Chad Ochocinco is talented and he's my personal favorite. But do his antics hurt the team?
That's a great question. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. I think they hurt the team more when the team's not playing well than when the team is. When they're playing well, he's playing well. It's all in fun, and it's just Chad being Chad. When they're not playing well, everybody's a little bit on edge, and people find reasons to turn things that ought to be positives and fun things into negative things. And so to answer your question, right now his antics are not well received.
The Bengals face the Dallas Cowboys this week, and they've got a lot in common. Star receivers with a penchant for elaborate celebrations, players who served long suspensions for code of conduct violations, and a past reputation for off-the-field troublemaking. Are the Bengals just the Cowboys without the winning?
Yeah, I mean, that's probably pretty accurate. In the NFL and in all pro sports, winning goes a long way toward cleansing lots of sins. Jerry Jones is a lot like Mike Brown in that he believes in taking chances on players with checkered pasts. The difference is Jerry Jones wins a lot of football games and doesn't get the negative attention that the Bengals get for doing the same thing, because the Bengals lose a lot of football games.
Fellow Ohioans, the Cleveland Browns, finally got their first win last week against the Bengals. How badly does that add insult to injury?
The rivalry between the Bengals and the Browns is one-sided. It's much more a rivalry in Cincinnati than it is in Cleveland. Cleveland would rather beat Pittsburgh and Baltimore than Cincinnati. That said, it is still a rivalry in Cincinnati, and that one stung, yeah, a little bit more than the others would.
Paul, the Bengals finished 7-9 last season. Do you think they can make 500 this year?
Not even close. If they win five, they're doing well.
Paul Dougherty is a columnist for the Cincinnati Inquirer and a host on radio station WLW. Paul, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Reside, providing vintage home accessories, lighting, and furnishings by 20th century classic modern designers. Collections on view at resideinc.com. And Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Legend has it that baseball, the most American of all games, was first played in 1846 when Alexander Cartwright's Knickerbockers lost to the New York Baseball Club at the Elysian Fields in Hoboken, New Jersey. That's rubbish, according to historians. And to add insult to injury, they've now documented at least one baseball game played nearly 100 years earlier in Guildford, England. The diary of William Bray, newly discovered in a garden shed, indicates that the game was well established in England in the 18th century, but that's not the end to the forward thinking of the sporting Brits. Surrey History Center manager Julian Pooley said, "What intrigues me is he is playing it with a load of young ladies." I'm Karen Given, sitting in for the vacationing Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, teen golfers who shun the links, worship the range, and dream of being the next Tiger. But first, Charlie Pierce is here with the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Karen.
Oakland Raiders owner Al Davis has given head coach Lane Kiffin the boot just 4 games into the season. Al Davis fired another head coach, Mike Shanahan, 4 games into the 1989 season, and Shanahan has done all right for himself. So should we expect young Mr. Kiffin to win a couple of of Super Bowls in the next few years?
Well, he might win a couple of BCS title games, because I think that his next stop, after he takes Al Davis to court to get his $6 million, is probably a head coaching job somewhere in the upper echelons of college. If I had to make a guess, I'd say someplace like Syracuse, where he has a bit of a connection with the athletic director. This is all about the one great problem for any group of sports fans that is now afflicting the fans of the Oakland Raiders. There's absolutely nothing you can do about a bad owner. You can't get rid of them. You have to wait for them to pass off this mortal coil. And unfortunately, the Oakland Raiders are going to be a mess as long as Al Davis owns them.
Well, the Raiders are likely looking to add to their coaching staff now, but if former Raider Warren Sapp has anything to do with it, they're not going to find anyone. Why is that?
Well, I think they'll find somebody. I'm thinking about Dennis Green. I'm thinking about Jim Fossil, who used to coach the Giants. Both of them have some redemption in their own minds to do, and they need any job in the league, and this is pretty much any job in the league. Warren Sapp is a loudmouth and a blowhard, but he's correct on this one. It's not Kiffin's fault. It's the fact that the Oakland Raiders are owned by a crazy man.
On Monday, New York Jets safety Eric Smith was suspended for one game and fined $50,000 for his helmet-to-helmet hit on Arizona Cardinals receiver Anquan Boldin. I'm glad to see the NFL taking these hits more seriously, Charlie, but by watching the replay, I'm not sure this one was intentional.
It's hard to tell, and it's going to take a couple of years to get guys to stop leading with their helmets the way they do. This was on the margin, but if you're going to make this a point of emphasis and you're going to try to get this to stop, the marginal calls are the ones that have to be made.
Good news. There is nothing to worry about in the Dallas Cowboys locker room. Despite earlier reports, it seems Terrell Owens is happy with the number of times Tony Romo is sending the ball in his direction. That's good, because it's hard to see how the Cowboys could target him more often.
Well, they sent it to him in one-third of the plays last week, and he was still upset. This is what Terrell Owens does in addition to, you know, running routes in practice and hitting the weight room. He runs his psychological menagerie out there to play. And I think it's part of what gets him ready for the game. Now, Dallas knew this when they brought him in. He's still a terrific receiver. He made one play last week that was just terrific, where he carried a couple of guys into the end zone. And this is what you get.
In the latest attempt to lift the curse of the billy goat, a priest from the Greek Orthodox Church sprinkled holy water in the Cubs' dugout on Wednesday. The Cubbies went on to lose Game 1 to the Dodgers 7-2 and Game 2 10-3. I don't know, should the Cubs maybe try a different religion before Game 3 tonight?
I advise the Cubs to go out and stack their roster full of people who really don't care whether or not the Cubs haven't won anything in a century. That's what the Red Sox did in 2004. They got a bunch of guys who didn't care about all the romantic nonsense that surrounded the franchise, and they finally won. This was really embarrassing, though. I mean, this is the first really good chance they've had to get to the World Series in at least a decade, and they came out and laid a gigantic egg in the first two games at Wrigley.
Well, it was a relief to many when the Red Sox and the White Sox won back-to-back World Series. Am I the only one who would like to see the Cubs win so we can stop talking about this?
No, you're not. Believe me, a grateful nation will rejoice.
The New York Mets were eliminated in their last game of the regular season, but Mets GM Omar Minaya has been given a contract through 2012. Good move?
Yeah, I mean, he has done his job. He has given his managers the players they need to compete, and obviously they've been competing for, you know, 157 games of the year. Sooner or later, probably sooner, maybe next year, they will break through this and make the playoffs. This is a guy who's rebuilt that franchise. They're moving into a new stadium. They don't need chaos in the front office. This is the best move they could have made.
Candace Parker is the first WNBA player to take Rookie of the Year and MVP honors, but she doesn't play for either of the WNBA finalists, does she?
No, so she got a phone call at home and said she'd much rather be playing in the finals. She's had quite a year, by the way. She had a great year, final year in college. She got an Olympic gold medal, and now she's the WNBA MVP and Rookie of the Year. It's okay that somebody else gets the championship rings, because she's got all the rest of the hardware.
NBA training camps open this week, Charlie. Everything has been coming up roses in the City of Roses.
Except!
But there was a calamity in Portland. What's going on?
Greg Oden got hurt again.
No!
He sprained his ankle. Yeah, rolled his ankle on the first day of practice. And, of course, anytime this guy starts limping, everybody in Portland reaches for a cane. I think this one will be fine, but it's going to be really nice for the people in Portland to see this guy play a regular season game.
The Golden State Warriors have a superhero-ish mascot, a fella named Thunder, but he could soon be gone. Why?
Because there's a team named the Thunder, or Thunder, in the NBA
of
now. The
course.
Oklahoma City guys. So Golden State may have to change this. He's a very odd-looking fellow. He looks like sort of you know, one of the guys who Batman had work on the suit before he actually used it. But he is going to have to change his name. I don't know what they change it to. I guess, you know, Golden State or Warrior or something.
There might be a worldwide credit crunch on Charlie, but never fear. IOC President Jacques Raga says organizers of the 2012 Games in London will still be able to borrow the money they need. Whatever happened to the illusion that the Olympic Games don't bankrupt the host city?
Well, if there's one thing that the IOC can count on, even in these perilous economic times, is that there are always lots of really wealthy suckers out there. And Jacques Roga knows this, so he's not worried about the future of his games at all.
The president of Brazil has been very critical of his national soccer team, a fact that rankled some of the players. Does President Da Silva realize who he's up against?
Julio Cesar, the goalkeeper, told him to go to Argentina. I mean, it doesn't get any bleaker than that. This guy, I mean, I don't know about Senor Da Silva's political skills in another area, but ripping the soccer team in Brazil is not a way to get yourself another term.
And finally, Charlie, we all know that vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin was dubbed Sarah Barracuda by her high school basketball team. But did you know that you can now buy your very own Sarah Cuda hunting bow?
I'm not going to answer this question the way you want me to, Karen, or perhaps even the way the guys in the booth want me to. I'm going to direct my answer to the American people. Oh, yeah, you betcha.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and he joins me or Bill each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Oh, thanks, Karen.
Since Tiger Woods turned pro in 1996, PGA Tour purses have increased by nearly 300%. According to Forbes, Tiger earned $115 million in 2007 alone, and the PGA Tour TV rankings swing up and down depending on whether he's in the mix. Not surprisingly, the search for the next Tiger has been on since he first donned the green jacket at Augusta. Tiger Woods isn't the focus of Kevin Cook's new book, Driven, Teen Phenoms, Mad Parents, Swing Science, and the Future of Golf, but Tiger's name is mentioned on nearly every page. Kevin Cook joins me from NPR's New York Bureau. Kevin, welcome back to Only a Game.
Hi, Karen. Thank you for having me on.
You spent a year at the David Ledbetter Academy in Bradenton, Florida. The academy is part of the larger IMG campus, where parents pay about $100,000 a year to have their children schooled in tennis, soccer, baseball, basketball, softball, swimming, and, of course, golf. Describe the campus for me.
Well, it's a beautiful place. It's lush. It's peopled with remarkable-looking kids. Anywhere else in America, you look around and you see a population of all different shapes and sizes. This is tremendously fit young people. You never know there was an obesity epidemic anywhere. highly motivated kids as well. A lot of students come and from other countries not speaking English. They're expected to speak English when they get to the Bradenton campus, and they do pick it up pretty quickly. Everyone seems pretty happy and highly motivated. I think this kind of thing contributes to what you could call the professionalization of youth. They are out practicing all the time on this huge, fabulous campus. One of the fascinating things that you do see, though, is here's a beautiful soccer pitch. Here's a golf course down the way that they can play for free. You don't see pickup games. You don't see spontaneous games because most of the young people down there don't figure it counts unless some adult is keeping score.
And they're always on the driving range, right?
Well, being IMG, the all-powerful agency, they wanted to have the young golfers a place where they could go conveniently and play, so they bought the country club down the road and have a heck of a time getting the kids to go over there and play. Even though they can play free, the young players of today would just as soon drive golf balls at the driving range, drill irons on the short game facility, practice for hour after hour after hour. I think with visions of PGA Tour and LPGA trophies in their heads.
This is, of course, David Ledbetter's academy. The actual students probably don't see a whole lot of Ledbetter, but how is his mark still on everything the academy teaches?
It's his method that is taught at the Ledbetter Academy in Bradenton. He is a remarkable fellow, a real student of the game. Like many great teachers, he was almost a fine player. He nearly made the European Tour, missed a 15-foot putt that he can still describe to you down to the quarter inch to earn his European Tour card. After that, he went into teaching, and after a long apprenticeship and a colorful one, went on to specialize with a couple of great players, Nick Price and Nick Faldo. Imagine this. Ledbetter made Nick Price go out and swing 8 irons until Price literally had a hole in the base of his 8-iron.
Most of Ledbetter's students don't go on to make millions of dollars on the pro tour, but they do earn scholarships to play golf in college. You've done the math, and that's return on investment of less than a dime per dollar. So why do the parents spend the money?
Well, I think that really is the essential question in the book. All of these stories in the book are family stories, and I think it's a wrenching and interesting decision when parents have to face their duty to the kid's talent. If your child has terrific talent in a sport and a desire to pursue it, to max out that talent, which is what they all say, what's your duty then? I think it's unfortunate that a lot of us couldn't begin to afford this particular kind of training, and this kind of training is going to wash out a lot of players who can't afford it. But the parents who are able to afford it really see this choice as something that they almost owe their kids to give them a chance to pursue their dream of playing golf for a living.
Well, one parent who has no trouble paying is Yvonne Lendl. Lendl is your typical Ledbetter dad, as long as you forget that he was the world's number one tennis player from 1983 to 1990. Four of his 5 daughters took golf seriously enough to enroll at Ledbetter's Academy, and the most promising is Isabel. I'm hoping you'll read a passage about her from page 42.
Happy to. Isabel had a quality sometimes called kick-assitude. Stronger than mere confidence, less toxic than arrogance, kick-assitude is a tigerish sense that you deserve to beat other players in the ground. In academy lore, the term dated back 10 years to when Maria Sharapova was a 9-year-old tennis prodigy at Bollettieri's Tennis Academy. One day, Nick Bollettieri alumna Martina Hingis, then ranked number 1 in the world, stopped by. After Hingis graciously rallied with the youngest girls at the academy, Bollettieri asked each one how it felt to hit with the Wimbledon champion. Super, the girl said. Awesome. Until he got to little Sharapova, who said, I hope she's still playing when I'm 16. I'm going to kick her ass. And that certainly is the quality that one finds, at least in the ones that seem to succeed in going on to the pros.
Of course, some of Ledbetter's students have burned out on pro golf. Possibly the most striking cautionary tale is Ty Tryon, whose name helped reinforce the idea that he could be the next Tiger. What happened to Ty?
Well, Ty's was the about 10 years ago the youngest player ever to earn his tour card. A remarkable performance, age 17. At the PGA Tour qualifying school, and he flamed out. He was unprepared, a little immature, some say. The thing that happens, as Ty explained it, and I believe this is true, is that if you are one of those phenoms who has never faced adversity on the course, you always dominated everyone your age, finally you get to the point you always felt that the whole ball was going to go in the hole, and it did. Then there is one day when it no longer does, and suddenly you seem to have lost a certain magic. That's when self-doubt creeps in, and in this most mental of games, self-doubt is something that can take years to overcome if you ever do overcome it. That's what we're seeing Michelle Wee deal with right now.
Well, speaking of Michelle Wee, she's probably the highest-paid golfer without an LPGA card. After a series of dismal performances, she's currently working her way through Q school to try to get back on the tour. Some have suggested that Wee suffers from lead poisoning, which is the name for the over-tinkering of a swing by David Ledbetter. But you seem to think that Michelle's problem is closer to home. What's that?
I found in working on Driven that you really do need to take things one step at a time. You go from dominating in junior golf to playing some college golf to going through the amateur ranks. That way you learn both how to step up your game at each point and to avoid that self-doubt, that can creep in if you do it too suddenly. And now she's really got to go back several levels to bring herself up. She's trying right now to qualify for next year's LPGA Tour. If she does go back and take it a step at a time, she might be able to achieve what many of us thought she might as perhaps the most talented female golfer in history.
You spent a year at Ledbetter's Academy. Do you think the next Tiger Woods is there?
I think there's a pretty good chance. It's all statistical questions. There's an awful lot of talent there. The next Tiger Woods might be Peter Uihlein, the son of the head of Titleist, who is a terrific player. And there's a young player named Mu Hu, who was the best junior player in China, whom I love. And I really hope, I mean, he's got a gorgeous swing. He has struggled with getting the ball in the hole at, under pressure sometimes. He's going to go to the University of Florida, and I hope to see him on the PGA Tour just so we can hear the galleries yell his name and they'll sound like cattle.
Kevin Cook is the author of Driven, Teen Phenoms, Mad Parents, Swing Science, and the Future of Golf, published by Gotham Books. He joined me from NPR's New York Bureau. Kevin, thanks for speaking with me.
Thank you. I enjoyed it, Karen.
And then begin your day. Only a Game is produced by Doug Tribou. Our technical director is John Parati. We had help this week from Meghna Chakrabarty, Mark Navin, Erica Bailey, and Peter Bombar at WUNC in Chapel Hill. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view Charlie Schroeder's Sueño Photo Gallery, download our weekly podcasts, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word is from Driven author Kevin Cook, who says that David Ledbetter's golf swing technique resonates with those of his students who are more technically oriented.
Yes, then it's like studying economics with Greenspan. Fully technical. Although we should probably avoid economics these days.
To which I have nothing to add, but yes, that's why I work on a sports show. I'm Karen Given. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week. You gotta swing it sweet and slow. At least you gotta try.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.